Part 1.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. At the same time, research into a backlash had begun. This time, instead of the movement of energy to matter, the movement of matter to energy was investigated. This reverse move had the opposite result. If the movement of energy into matter led to creation, the movement of matter into energy had a high power of destruction. By the way, most of the scientists who noticed this destructive power in America were scientists from the Jewish background. Scientists like Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. These scientists had migrated from Eastern Europe. They decided to inform the American authorities about the heinous power after feeling the danger that the German Nazis were about to discover the secret of the reverse movement of creation. They wrote to Albert Einstein and asked him to write a letter to the President of the United States. In that letter, he mentioned the destructive power of a newly discovered energy and informed that the Nazis were making a devastating bomb based on this energy. This letter attracted the attention of then-President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt. At that time, only 2 months had passed since the start of World War II, and the United States had still remained neutral. On October 21, 1939, a meeting of the Special Committee to investigate this issue was held with the presence of Jewish scholars, Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. The result of this meeting was that uranium can be the source of production of bombs that were more destructive than any other material ever experienced in the world. They proposed a budget of $167,000 for uranium research. They mainly studied uranium-235 isotope and a new substance called plutonium. The Americans chose a Jewish physicist from the University of California to lead the bomb production project, J. Robert Oppenheimer. He held various meetings in U.S. universities with many physicists to investigate possibilities and solutions. The American government informed the research group that it would provide them with any kind of financial, human, and logistical assistance. Oppenheimer was a Jew, but he was very interested in Indian mythology. One of the myths was Mahabharata, the national epic of Indians. A part of this epic was called Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu, the Hindu god, wore war clothes and became the destroyer of the worlds. J. Robert Oppenheimer was designing the most destructive weapon in history, and he saw this myth as his source of inspiration. The Destroyer of Worlds was an inverse reflection of the Jewish creation myth, the return of matter to energy, and the subsequent destruction of the world. On December 18, 1941, Japanese fighter jets attack Pearl Harbor. Let's remember Pearl Harbor, as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Following the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, the United States declared war on Japan and Germany. U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called his country arsenal of democracy and aroused the emotions of members of Congress with a sensational speech.
Since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Franklin D. Roosevelt knew that war was America's first priority from then on. Japanese were fierce warriors, so the Manhattan Project had already become important for the U.S. At the same time, hatred against Japanese and Germans was being propagated all over America. The U.S. propaganda machine also used Walt Disney animation. The U.S. had entered into chaos. The intense propaganda of the American government for enlistment began. American soldiers went to war in the Pacific Ocean. Some soldiers went to Europe. Humanity experienced the most terrible war until that time, a kind of war that was a direct product of modern times. The Japanese also had a myth similar to the Jews for the creation of the world. In the oldest Japanese legends, the world before creation was nothing but formless matter. Something called chaos. The silence reigned in the time of turmoil and disorder. Suddenly, the sound arose and particles began to move. The movement of particles created light. Thus, light was placed at the highest place in the world, and below it were particles that first created clouds and then heaven. The Japanese concept of light and then cloud had a strange similarity with the Jewish concept of light and then water. The movement of particles in Japanese mythology led to the creation of light energy. The cloud was formed, and under that was heaven. In the modern era, this myth took on a frightening and twisted description. Far from the two fronts of Europe and the Pacific Ocean, the nuclear scientists of America, England, and Canada continued their research in silence. Oak Ridge in Tennessee was the first proposed area for research. The government forcibly seized 56,000 acres of land in this area worth $3.5 million to carry out its research. Later, another 3,000 acres were added to the area. 1,000 families had lost their land under the influence of the government's behavior. Complaints and legal procedures of these citizens against the government did not reach any conclusion, though. Finally, people complained to their Congress representatives, but the Congress investigation could not challenge the government's decision. Some of these families had lived in these properties for generations, but they had to vacate their land within 2 weeks, according to the military order. The army did not pay the families more than $47 per acre. The villagers had no choice but to sell their land. Oak Ridge nuclear research was mostly theoretical from then on. It seemed the Jewish immigration scientists and Americans still had a long way to go to the practical stage of nuclear fission. But finally, in 1943, the research entered the phase of practical experiments. For several months, the Army and scientists were looking for a suitable place to carry out the experiments. J. Robert Oppenheimer owned a large land in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He suggested conducting the experiments in that area. Jemez Springs in New Mexico was another alternative. But this area was surrounded by Rocky Mountains. Oppenheimer did not like the area and said that in order for the employees not to be afraid, it was better to find a wide and flat area. Finally, Los Alamos was chosen. Oppenheimer went to Los Alamos and was impressed by the beauty of nature. Since then, the beautiful area was a secret laboratory of American nuclear bombs. With the continuous activity of uranium enrichment centers, the United States was finally able to obtain 50 kilograms of uranium-235 with a purity of 89% by July 1945. Nuclear scientists entered a new stage, designing the bomb. At the same time, the war continued. Little by little, the Allies' success became evident. The Americans, with the support of the British, entered the mainland of Europe in the invasion of Normandy and the north of France. On August 25, 1944, Paris was liberated. In Europe, the war was in the favor of the Allies. In Asia, Japan surrounded the Assam region of India, but finally retreated. In the Pacific, America was able to defeat the Japanese forces in the Palau Islands. The naval battles between America and Japan in the Pacific Ocean ended one after another in favor of the Americans. Far from these battles, in the seemingly calm but quiet deserts of Los Alamos, nuclear scientists had come to the conclusion that they had to conduct an experiment and detonate the first bomb for test. Before carrying out that experiment, Germany was captured in April 1945. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. Managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics. The third god was a creator god, or Brahma, similar to Jewish creation myths. But in front of him were gods with destructive forces. Scientists bet on the Trinity test. Some predicted that the bomb would not work. Some predicted its strength up to 45 tons of TNT. Another Jewish physicist, Isidore Isaac Rabi, predicted that the bomb would have the power of 18,000 tons of TNT. He was almost right. Isidore Isaac Rabi won that bet.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The first atomic bomb was tested at 5:29 and 45 seconds a.m. Mountain War Time on July 16, 1945. The explosion almost equaled 20,000 tons of TNT. A pit with a diameter of 340 meters and a depth of 3 meters was made at the place of the explosion. Observers who were at least 16 kilometers away from the epicenter reported the high heat during the blast. The surrounding mountains seemed brighter than usual for a few seconds. The sky looked purple, which gradually changed to green and finally turned white. 40 seconds after the explosion, they suddenly heard its sound. The blast waves shook up to a radius of 160 kilometers. Kenneth Bainbridge, one of the test directors, remarked to J. Robert Oppenheimer immediately after the test, "Now, we are all sons of bitches." Oppenheimer later said that at the moment of seeing the first nuclear explosion, he was thinking of a passage from the mystical book of Hindu religion. In a part of the book, the Hindu god says, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." At that time, Harry Truman had become president of the United States and was at Potsdam Conference. Potsdam was located in occupied Germany. Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and Harry S. Truman attended the conference. The conference was held to clarify the situation of post-war Europe and defeated Germany.
"Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender. I want the entire world to know that this direction must and will remain unchanged and unhampered."
On the other hand, participants in the conference were waiting for the outcome of the war in the Pacific Ocean and Asia, Japan. Harry S. Truman received a coded telegram at Potsdam at 7:30 p.m. on July 16th. "Operated on this morning. Diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceed expectations." Harry S. Truman informed Stalin that America had achieved a new and powerful weapon. On July 26, 1945, the Allies issued and announced an ultimatum which outlined the terms of surrender for the Empire of Japan. The ultimatum stated that if Japan did not surrender, it would face prompt and utter destruction, but this statement did not talk about the new bomb.
"Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine. If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany. Our blows will destroy their whole modern industrial plant and organization, which they have built up during the past century and which they are now devoting to a hopeless cause. We have no desire or intention to destroy or enslave the Japanese people, but only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance.
In the first days of August 1945, the United States announced the names of several cities as targets of airstrikes by spreading leaflets over Japanese cities. The Japanese people thought that they were just bombings of conventional weapons, and news of the invention of the nuclear bomb had not yet spread. The United States did not mention Hiroshima among the cities it warned, while Hiroshima was the first target of the Americans for nuclear bombing. The Americans chose the bomb, the little boy, for Hiroshima.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi in his Adab al-Salat, again a monumental work by the great Imam, in the opening lectures, opening durus of this book, he talks about a concept that he refers to as عِزَّةِ رُبُوبِيَّ ذِلَّةِ عُبُودِيَّ. That one of the things that we need to train ourselves on to even enter the realm of Salat is the عِزَّة, the power, the majesty, the respect of Allah's رُبُوبِيَّ and the degradation of my subservience. The villate ubudiyah. The faster I get there, the faster I make myself zalil and him aziz. The faster I make myself the abd and him the mawla. The faster I make the one who's marzuq and him the raziq, the marhum, the rahim, or whatever the case may be, the more this salat will what infiltrate into my soul. So he spends a good 3 or 4 chapters now talking about this, because one block when it comes to salat is, yes, people like me go up and down, ruku, sujood, but this mi'raj mu'min doesn't happen. I've been praying for over 20 years. I don't know how many times I've experienced this mi'raj, this ascension that the hadith talks about. All of you, mashallah, the mu'mineen. So I fulfill the salat, it's there on time, it's a checklist, that's great, but ascension... I don't know about all of you, but these things are tough for me to really measure inside of me, which means that I'm doing something wrong. Yes, I'm going through the motions of wudu is following the rules. I have 7 spots on my body in during sujood. I do all of that. I do my best. But this spiritual sense is not there. And he explains why. And follow this discussion, please. I talk to myself up here. He says that ultimately we are the musafirin. He uses sair and suluk up and down their book. The suluk is the path, the salik is you and I, the journeyman. Okay, or the musafir, the traveler. He says a journey individual, a musafir, one who's doing safar, let's say, for example, they have certain alamat, certain signs. Right? You see a boarding pass, you see a passport, you see a suitcase, right? Maybe some different currency. Okay? You could tell this guy is about to go on a plane. Or he's packing his car, let's say, for example. He started his car, for example. He's about to go on a road trip. The car is packed, everything, you know, up and down, blah, blah, blah. There's all these signs. He's about to embark on a journey. There's physical signs. He says, imagine now, Imam Khomeini, imagine walking to somebody's house and they're sitting there on their couch, no sign of a suitcase, no boarding pass, no passport, nothing. He's in his home clothes. And he says, yeah, I'm on a journey right now. I'm traveling. He's like, well, where are you traveling right now? How are you traveling right now? You're sitting there in your room, in your home. How could you be traveling? Picking up the signs of a physical journey are easy enough. Imam Khomeini says we are in a spiritual journey constantly. If that physical journey has alamat and signs, the spiritual one does as well. He says, what are those spiritual ones? He says, we have to leave the home of the self. Follow the example. It's a very beautiful discussion he has. He's an arif, he's a faqih, he's a poet, he's a philosopher. You see all of that in his writing. This is that one book. These are not, you know, these are not his students writing out his durus. He wrote this book by his own hands in Farsi. He says there are signs that we are spiritually on our journey. Every single one of us are on a spiritual journey. We are on this sair, this kind of journey towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Are there signs that I am a musafir? Yes, there are signs. What are those signs? He says you have to leave your home to be able to travel physically, right? Same idea. He says you have to leave the home of the self internally to be able to travel towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he gives a very beautiful example, comparing some fiqhi rulings to what I'm talking about. Back in the day, in order for you to be considered to be a musafir, for you now to have your salat to be qasr, and for you not to fast, there are certain signs. Nowadays we have a calculation of miles and kilometers. Back then they had other signs. Okay? One sign was that you would leave your town or city to the point where you couldn't see the walls of the buildings of your town. If you could no longer see the walls of the building of your town, you were far enough, let's say, to be considered to be a musafir. You're no longer muqim in that village. Okay? What else? When you can no longer hear the adhan from the masjid inside of your town, you are now considered to be far enough to be a musafir. Okay? He uses these two fiqhi examples to make his point. He says, the same way that a physical musafir has to now be invisible towards the walls of the town and be deaf towards the adhan of the salat, is the same way the spiritual sense has to be invisible to the walls of his own praise and the adhan of his own ego. The moment that we turn deaf to our own praise, now we've left home. Beautiful. Because home is where the ego is. Home is where narcissism is. Home is where the ana is. Home is where the me-centric is. And we live in a very me-centric world today. The whole talk about the me generation. It's not just my beautiful youth out there. All of us now have been affected by this me-centric generation. So the moment that you spiritually leave the home, where now the ana is no longer important, now you have your suitcase, now you're traveling, now you are a true musafir towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when you worship Allah in that journey, then there's talks of mi'raj. But like I said in the discussion on perfection, sometimes that very worship that should lead us to Allah leads us to shaitan. And it becomes for somebody else. In order for all of you and myself to understand the power of being distinct Islamically in this day and age, and that means not just clothing, that means our habits, that means that I will not do this, I won't drink this, even though everyone's doing it, I won't smoke this, everyone's doing it, I won't watch this, it's every hashtag out there. We have to be okay with the fact that if somebody asked me about, let's say, I don't know, the season recap of this show, you can say with confidence, I don't watch that, I'm sorry. Knowing full well, they might look and say, oh, okay, all right. I don't go here. I don't listen to this. I don't wear this. I don't quite believe in this. We have to now get that vocabulary inside of us. And that will make us absolutely distinct. And you're bound to get a moment where the person in front of you rejects you, either through a stare, or they awkwardly stare at you, or they awkwardly walk away, or they become awkward themselves. Like if somebody comes out and begins to shake your hand, and you put your hand in your chest for 3.2 seconds, oh, awkward. And the person in front now, sometimes they make it even more awkward. They stumble, they fumble, their, you know, their pen drops, their, it's okay, relax, calm down, it's okay. Just say hello, that's it. Okay, that's it. And the whole interview, the whole talk is, can't look at you, look down. Right? So we have to be okay with that. We have to be okay with that. Because it can't be the fact that everything that is norm in society is accepted by the human being. That can't happen. I'm sorry. Because right now, those things that are normal sometimes in any society, and no longer I'm talking about East and West. I'm not that speaker that sits there and bashes this West and bashes that West. I think a global movement now towards a me-centric life is, like I said, global.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyim وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, ladies out there. Welcome to another episode of Muslim Lady. Well, I am Asma, your humble host, and here with me, as the common ritual of recent sessions, we have Sister Zainab. We are going through the ethics of the life of Sayyidah Zahra Salamullah alayha. Actually, this is the book that we have in here, and we're working on it. We're picking out the outlines that are very much important in order to be useful for the Muslim ladies out there. And Sister Zainab is helping us with that. Assalamu alaikum, Sister, and welcome to your program.
Walaikum assalam, Sister Asma. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, just would you like to give us a brief introduction about yourself and the book, of course?
All right. I am Zainab Askari, and I have been reading this book, Ethics and Lifestyle of Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha. I read it some long time ago. I had been teaching it to different languages, English, and I have been teaching it in Kashmiri.
Mm-hmm.
I have also been teaching this in Urdu, and I have got a very, very good response. People who did not know Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha, especially Muslim women, have been very, very thankful for getting to know about the ethics an individual should have.
Yeah, and as long as we have been familiar with this book, since you're teaching us about it, it's been quite interesting, actually.
Yeah.
We went through too much of ethics related to table manners, related to the beauty, which is something very much attractive to all the women. And also we went through slipping and plenty much more. Well, we talked about the rituals that we must be careful before we go to sleep, according to the lifestyle and manners of Sayyidah Zahra Salamullah alayha. Now, I remember that you said we are going to have some rituals for the aftermath.
Exactly. So we talked about sleeping in, I guess, two sessions. And now, when to wake up?
Yeah.
You have been working all throughout the day. Now you're tired and you want to sleep for so, so long. You don't want any disturbance. But what we have, again, Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family, recommending Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha. He says her, O Fatima, don't be among the ignorant people who sleep in the time of the morning Fajr prayers until the sun rises. So in between this time,
he, that is the dawn,
highly recommends her to not sleep from the very early dawn to the sunrise.
Yeah.
So this is the time of provision, sustenance, whatever you get, because the angels are distributing
the blessings of the sky.
Yes. And don't be among the ignorant, Fatima. Don't go for sleep this time. You know, all the women out there are always behind this. How do I get this barakat in my life? How do I get the blessings? How do I get more in my life? How do I increase this sustenance or a provision, whatever you are yourself providing to your family or your husband is helping you financially? How do I increase it? So here's the secret.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anyone in the world who loves to be poor?
Of course not.
Of course, we don't have any such people. But we have so many recommendations. We have another saying from Imam Ali al-Islam. If you don't want to be in the poverty line, do not sleep in this time from the morning dawn to the until the sun rises. From the basically the time when you when the morning prayers start, the azan, when you hear the call of azan, and then when the sun rises.
The time of twilight.
Exactly. Do not sleep in that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'll tell you what happens in that time.
And since all the mothers and all the sisters and all the Muslim ladies out there are
they
very...
They have to start their day out there.
Yeah, and they are very much careful, very much attracted to know more about how to, just as you mentioned, how to gather all the blessings in their family.
Exactly. As I said, like Imam Ali Islam says, do not sleep in this time. He also says another time. He says the time when you offer your Maghrib prayers and your Isha prayers, do not, you know, the time which is very close to that time, do not sleep in that time. So he recommends two times to stay out of poverty line. And women are so much attracted to this thing that we don't want to be in the
power.
Yeah,
they're so much eager.
Because they are suffering, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even if a man goes out and earns money, or even a woman goes out and earns money, she wants it to be, you know, lasting for a long time. Or she wants barakat, she wants blessings in everything. She wants increase.
And you know what? As a mother, as a wife, you would be very much sad if something wrong happens with your family. You would be very much sad if you go through poverty.
You would be actually sad if you're not able to sustain your family for throughout the month. You have to wait for example, you know, everyone receives salary on the first of the month. And then if it gets finished on the 10th, you're very, very upset with this. Someone who gets affected the most mentally, physically even, is the woman.
Yeah, that's very much true, sister. Thank you.
So the secret is here.
Yeah.
Wake up early.
Yeah. So thank you, dear listeners. We're talking about when to wake up, actually, and when not to sleep. And we're going to catch up the topic after a little break. So thank you for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, Muslim ladies. We are talking about when to wake up and the rituals of the aftermath of sleeping. We said that we've been tired, we've been going through too much of chores and works, and we know that nowadays ladies are working just side by side their men, definitely, and they would feel worn out. So what happens is that they go to bed, they sleep, and then maybe they have to actually go to work the other day. So she has to wake up in the very much morning. Because that is going to be the satisfaction of Allah. And at the very same time, the time you actually mentioned, the twilight between the dawns, is going to be the time of dispensing all the blessings to the inhabitants of the earth.
Exactly. So that's the time when these blessings are distributed. And Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, suggested his daughter, don't be among the ignorant if you want to have those blessings, if you want to actually, you know, grab them. And then we have from other imams as well who quote the same thing from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. Now I'll give you some of the examples from the real today life. Among the non-Muslims even, we have seen early birds of very, very successful. We have Michael Gass, who's a president and innovator at Starbucks. Starbucks is a multinational coffee house chain. And then she wakes up exactly at 4:30 a.m. and goes running. And then when she starts her day like this, she has been saying in many interviews that this is her 15-year routine. And that's how she turned a team of just three to today managing 33 foreign countries. It's not a joke. Like a woman who started her team with three people is now managing 33 foreign countries. And she says, what is my reason why I do this? She says that because I am taking care of myself, morning runs clear my mind. Morning runs come when you wake up early.
Yeah, that's very true.
So we have another, like, as many of the world's most powerful women, they have discovered that rising before the sun is more than just a personal bonus. It's an edge in the cutthroat corporate environment. I'll give more examples, like Avon Chief, Indira Jung, wakes up at 5 a.m. She hits the gym and is at her desk by 8 a.m. We have newswoman Anne Curry. She's out of bed at 3:45. That's so, so early now because there are some night owls who just go to bed at 3:45. There's another Vogue editor. She's a very long-time Vogue editor, Anna Wintour, who is on the tennis court by 6 a.m. And even the research has shown that early birds really get out the worm. There are birds who are in search of worm all the time. They get the worms when they go out for searching them very early. It's a research.
And sister, you know what? It's very much common. We can see it with our eyes. There are plenty, since we're living in a Muslim country, we see plenty much of these Muslim ladies as doctors, as even pilots or
you
teachers.
Interview any successful woman, interview any successful woman, she will tell you definitely she's not among the night owls. She's not among those waking up throughout the night. There are early risers.
Exactly.
And there's one more research from North Texas University in 2008 who identified that morning people earned significantly higher grades than those who wake up later. So, you know, there are so many people like who have proved that this was about success. Now, what does science say about it? Because I have, you know, since I read this, I always try to compare what Islam says with what science says. So science also says that when your retina, eyes, see light, they do not induce hormones that create sleep. But when they see darkness, they induce hormones that make you feel sleepy. Your body also is a fine-tuned machine. So do not disturb it. Do not do like we have been recommended. Night is for sleeping, night is for rest, and days are for working. Because there are so many people out there who debate that I'm very, very satisfied in, I'm very, very actually relaxed in working at night than in the morning hours. Try it in the morning hours.
Yes, Sister Zainab, that was very much true. As I told you, since we're living in a Muslim country, we can see that with our eyes. There are plenty much of women, Muslim ladies out there that are doing plenty much of wonders out there. You know, they're being mothers at the same time. They're handling different jobs outside the home. Yet, just like you mentioned, they sleep very much early at night and then they wake up very much early in the morning. You know what? We had a professor at university and then he used to tell us that the owner of the house is the person who comes to the home, actually the most early of everyone else. They wake up very much early in the morning. And then she slips the lastest one in the home. She is going to be the one who actually owns the credit of being the owner of the, you know, the table of that home. So actually what he meant was that the
make others sleep early.
Exactly,
so that you sleep early.
Yes. So the center of a house is a woman that is giving with her warmth and with her knowledge about what she's doing and going through. She's going to be the center of the house. And we are telling all these things to Muslim ladies because they are the ones who are going to teach the other generations, their children, to be true personalities. So, dear ladies, let's go for a short break and we'll be back in no time. Thank you for staying tuned.
When you wake up early, you can do a lot of things. You can create a healthy breakfast because when you wake up late, you, as a mother, as a daughter of the house, you do everything late.
Exactly.
You try to just warm up some freeze stuff or that's not healthy.
You would be in a hurry all the day.
Yes, you'll be throughout all, in your old jobs and you will be mentally, you won't be productive. But research out there have proven that early risers are very, very productive. They are very, very systematic. They are very, very, you know,
and very
organized.
Successful, of course.
They're organized. Mm-hmm. And since they're organized, they're successful.
So thank you, sister. And thank you, dear listeners. In recent sessions, we were talking about the rituals of resting. And then we learned plenty much of things. Actually, from the lifestyle of Sayyida Zahra Salamullah Alayha, we learned that when she went to bed, she actually turned her bed into a mosque by reciting the Holy Book of Quran and doing the rituals that you already mentioned in the previous session. And then in this session, we talked about getting out of bed pretty much early because then the early risers are the more successful people. And since we want all the Muslim ladies out there to be successful, we are just mentioning these things in this program in order to make them enrich their knowledge of the lifestyle of their role model, that is Sayyida Zahra Salamullah Alayha. So thank you. Thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, dear listeners. Until another session, I bid you farewell. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files.
Around 2 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, November 28, 1953, something rather strange happened at a New York City hotel. A scientist got up in the middle of the night, ran across a dark room, avoiding two beds, and dove through a closed window with the shades and curtains down, then died soon after he hit the ground. His name was Frank Olson, and his death would help uncover a series of secret CIA operations involving the lives of thousands. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today's mind-blowing topic is a CIA mind control project called MKUltra. The story of MKUltra is at times so surreal that one may think it's the plot of a science fiction movie, but unfortunately, it is very much true and affected thousands of people around the world, although no one is sure of the actual numbers because of the secrecy of the program. It was a Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, top secret program, which used humans as guinea pigs to test a range of drugs that could force confessions or brainwash individuals through various forms of psychological torture. Well, you see, in the 1950s, the CIA initiated this program to experiment with forms of mind control in order to, and I quote, to catch up with the Soviets and Chinese advances in the field. 80 institutions and 185 private researchers had contracts with the CIA to perform this work, and they were located around the world, as were their victims. So Sidney Gottlieb was the CIA's main man handling this project. He was a chemist, and some of his experiments were covertly funded at universities and research centers. Others were conducted in American prisons and in detention centers in Japan, Germany, and the Philippines. Now, according to journalist Stephen Kenzer, Gottlieb wanted to create a way to seize control of people's minds, and he realized that it was a two-part process. Well, first, you had to blast away, imagine that, blast away the existing mind. Second, you had to find a way to insert a new mind into that resulting void. Well, according to Kenzer, the United States didn't get too far on number two, but they did a lot of work on number one. There were a core group of scientists around the world who were part of MKUltra. LSD, sleep deprivation, and electric shock treatments were their favorite tools to use on their victims, but it was not limited to those. They would induce people into a high with putting them into having hallucinations, then giving them a drug to bring them down, and while in between these phases, some of them would give their victims mini electric shock treatments, basically having people lose their minds. Take a look at this.
This is where I have my effect, in the mind.
This is lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as acid. The powerful drug was first synthesized in 1938 in Switzerland. With a dose of mere micrograms, the mind becomes confused. Perception is distorted. Personal identity is called into question. The results can be euphoric bliss or deadly panic.
So that was how LSD was introduced to this country.
Operation Midnight Climax is part of a larger top-secret CIA program called MKUltra. The goal, learn how to control and even reprogram people's minds. The CIA believes LSD might hold the key. Over the next 10 years, the agency doses a cross-section of the American public. Everyone from unwitting housewives to soldiers to even criminals like gangster Whitey Bulger is tested.
You know, what the CIA really dreamed of was sort of like a drug you could give to someone, get them to commit all sorts of unspeakable acts, and they wake up the next day and they don't remember what they've done.
They were looking into brainwashing. They were looking into mind control. They were looking into how they could create what they called Manchurian candidates. They were trying to figure out if they could get people to go out and do things that they would ordinarily not do, like assassinations.
The case of MKUltra has to be one of the craziest cases of blowback in CIA history, because here they took this drug, LSD, and thought that they were going to be able to use it to control people's minds. And the unbelievable irony is that LSD is a drug that does exactly the opposite. It frees your mind and causes people to question authority.
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
The CIA's attempt to control people turned out to be just the opposite. It created the counterculture, as we know it, of the 60s. It was the CIA that introduced LSD to the United States.
So not only was the goal of this program brainwashing, but also reprogramming to get the victim to do anything the CIA wanted, even assassinations, and without the victim having the slightest memory of what he had done. The United States was concerned during the Korean War, where many American prisoners of war were confessing to the Koreans that they had actually used germ warfare on their country and were apologetic. Over 7,000 POWs petitioned the U.S. to end the war, and 21 of the soldiers even refused to return to the United States after the war. Well, Washington thought all of this was because of brainwashing techniques, which they thought had been used on the soldiers, but that was not the case. However, it did not prevent the U.S. from starting this aggressive and inhumane program to learn how to control humans by brainwashing them. Officially, the MKUltra program ended when information started seeping out after Olson's case was finally looked into. You know, he was the guy I introduced to you at the beginning of the program, the scientist who was set up to look like he committed suicide, but was most likely killed by the same CIA that he had worked for. It seemed that after he was given an LSD dosage, that he had a bit of a conscience and couldn't take the torture to others any longer. And Gottlieb and others, even higher up, knew that he needed to be silenced before he exposed what they were doing. Much about this program came to light 20 years after Olson's death, and because of the public exposure, the program was officially ended. However, there are those who say it never really ended, but just took on other forms. Let's get my guests involved in this discussion.
James Martinez is a media ecologist, radio talk show host, and pioneer in radio broadcasting and behavior modification. Born in San Diego, California, he's an accredited member of the Press for American Media Distribution. Martinez has been a consultant for True TV's Conspiracy Theory and has consulted for Emmy Award-winning actor Ian Bailey for a show entitled Imagine This.
Oh, thank you so much, James, for being with us. I'd like to start off with this. How would you describe MKUltra to our audience?
MKUltra was brought over from Europe during World War II, where they were perfecting behavior modification using child abuse and satanic cult ritual. Those were the melting pots for what was to be used. Originally, most people think MKUltra had to do with being able to utilize behavioral software to override the conscious mind of an individual that was pre-programmed for instance, assassination. But it wasn't only for assassination. it was used for political purposes as well. And it was done through ritualistic abuse originally. That's how it started. These ritual abusive techniques were used to create deep-seated trauma within the psyche, and then around the